I'm Ian Fernigworth, a historian studying Australia's naval history and writing books about it.
Ian, you are ex-Navy. You're a veteran.
Yeah, I had 35 years in the RAN, man and boy. I joined when I was 15 and I left when I was just over 50.
Our listeners will be saying, what ships did you serve on?
Oh, a long list, Helen, but it included the aircraft carrier Melbourne, a number of destroyers and frigates, British ships as well. I had exchange service with the Royal Navy. I served in minesweepers. I had time in support ships. I commanded the guided missile destroyer Perth. And in between all that, I had shore postings and postings to staffs. And I also had, apart from the British posting, I had three postings overseas.
We're going to go on to a particular book that you've just written, but just a brief overview of other books that you've written.
Well, I thought I knew a lot about the Royal Australian Navy until I started researching it, and then I discovered how little I knew. And that came about because I decided to take a master's degree at the University of Newcastle, later upgraded to a PhD, and I chose the naval history subject as my thesis, started researching and started discovering things I didn't know. And that's been the story throughout my career as a researcher and writer, that I keep discovering things I didn't know. And if I didn't know them, I'm pretty sure nobody else did. So I guess you could say my books are all about things that people don't know or didn't know.
Do you think that a great deal of people just don't know much at all about the Navy at any rate?
Oh, 99.9%, I'd say. I'd include members of the Royal Australian Navy in that too. Because the Navy is focused, as it should be, on defending the country and acting on behalf of the government, and that's where its focus is. It's not on history. But it is a shame that during the process of educating and training our young men and women, they don't get a very good history of the Royal Australian Navy from which to work.
Do you think that the media have a role to play in not ensuring that the general populace knows about their Navy?
Oh, absolutely. Put Digger in front of anything and the press will be all over it like a rash. Put Sailor in front of it and they won't be interested. I'm not slanging the media. I mean, they take their cues from other sources, but fair's fair. We just had 4 years of centenary of Anzac. How many times did you hear the Navy mentioned and all that? And yet the Navy was there the whole time.
Well, you have certainly come a long way to educating the general populace about the Navy. Your latest book is Bravo Zulu 2. We've interviewed you before about Bravo Zulu 1. What's Bravo Zulu all about?
The project started back in 2009 as a casual conversation, as these things do. And a colleague and I, we'd done some work together on researching previous books, thought it was a pity there wasn't much written about the honours and awards received by members of the Royal Australian Navy. There was some wartime stuff, but the Navy hasn't been at war for that long. In comparison, most of its operations have occurred in peacetime. But there was absolutely no record of that, and we thought, well, we should rectify that. Here's an opportunity. How hard can it be? And off we went. That was the Bravo Zulu project started.
Was the research task what you expected it to be?
No, it was quite different. Because we work a lot with archives, and we'd assumed that the Navy, amongst other people, had managed to do what they were supposed to do under the Archives Act and put this material into the National Archives, that we'd simply duck down the archives, find the files, copy down the citations, and Bob would be our uncle. We'd have to do a little more research on the background of the people receiving the awards, but the major thing, why they got the award, would have been made quite clear. That was about as far from the truth as you can get, because while we were able to track an awful lot of stuff from the early days right up until probably Korea, it got a bit more difficult after that for two reasons. One is the Navy decided to change its personnel system, this personal record system, to an EDP system, which meant that the old paper records, which had their faults, were no longer kept. And therefore, trying to find out when a guy joined the Navy or when a girl was promoted petty officer was very difficult indeed.
Goodness, you mean to tell me that they didn't bother transcribing all those old records onto electronic data?
That's right.
That's amazing.
I mean, I'd get a phone call and the people would say, we found a cardboard box you might be interested in. And I'd have a look inside and there would be all the recommendations for honours and awards for 1967. Where the hell it had been and where was the rest? Nobody knew.
Was there any time when you thought the work involved in doing the research was a bit beyond you?
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of 2012, the two of us, because there are only two to start off with, did an assessment and came up with the grim fact that of all that we thought we had about 3,500 recipients to research, we still had 2,000 to go, and we had absolutely no idea of how we were going to contact those people or discover their service histories, and least of all would we find out why they got their gongs. It was a very grim moment in the project, and at that point we very nearly gave up, but we didn't. We thought about it and advertised for mostly with people we knew or people who knew people. We were looking for a team of researchers to join us and to take up the fight. Very fortunately, we had five or six people step forward.
Oh, that's great. And what did they bring to the project?
Well, they brought new perspectives. We obviously, both officers, had been through the college and so forth, had the officer-like experiences. We had very little from the sailor side, and we had dealt mainly in policy matters. So neither of us had done much time in the personnel world, which was where all this data was kept and recorded. Therefore, we needed people who had done work in that area, and we discovered them. They were great. More than that, they weren't quite as jaded as we were. They brought new ideas to the project, particularly on how to track down people. We were using the white pages, and one of our new guys decided, why don't we use the Australian Electoral Commission's role? So we did, and you know that? That worked, really did.
That's good.
You can hide, but you can't hide from the Australian Electoral Commission. There you go.
That's true, or the ATO usually.
We thought about going to the ATO and we decided, well, let's not do that.
So what happened when these new researchers started contacting people? How were they received?
Well, there was some, I won't say suspicion, but there was, as we all know, the phone rings when we're sitting down to dinner at night and somebody wants to sell us stuff for our roof or talk to us about some product or other. We had a few knockbacks, but the majority of the people were curious. I mean, why was this happening? Who were we, for a start? I mean, they expected we would be the Navy, but we weren't the Navy. And although we had, I suppose you'd call it top cover from the Navy, saying this is a good idea and we hope it succeeds, it didn't go a lot beyond that. It wasn't able to for reasons of privacy, which these are public awards announced publicly by the Governor General of the country and advertised in newspapers and radio shows and interviews, and it's private. We couldn't have details. That was a bit of a hard pill to swallow, but we did. And what we found is people generally were, A, having got over the surprise and shock that someone rang them up and said, what about the gong you got in Queen's Birthday 1987? And having established our bona fides, which we could do fairly easily, they were very willing to cooperate, or at least the vast majority were. And from there it became not necessarily easy, but easier.
They were probably quite thrilled that somebody was taking an interest in them.
Well, that was the second response. I don't want to pick on anybody at all or the Navy and blame it, but there has been a culture of, oh, yeah, Joe Blow got a gong, but let's not talk about it because lots of other people didn't. I think that's a shame. As the research showed, everybody who got an award deserved it, more than deserved it. And the fact that why they got it and the example, the work they'd put into it, the bravery they showed, the initiative they showed, was certainly, I think, one of the outstanding features of our research. Why you would cover that up, I've no idea.
So all of these stories went into your two books, Bravo Zulu, Volume 1 and Volume 2. When it came to writing the manuscripts, how do you tie all those individual stories together?
To use a stock standard phrase, with great difficulty. That really was the question, because we decided from the beginning that we wouldn't write this for the greybeards, the ex-Navy people, the veterans. We would write it for Australia, because Australia owns a Navy. Every Australian citizen owns part of a Navy and an Air Force and an Army, but we're talking about the Navy. Therefore, this is their story. It wasn't a story for the Navy to feel good about. It's a story for the nation to feel good about. So how could you do that? Well, I don't know how many books of naval history you've read, but and I find military history extremely difficult to follow because it's always the second thing of climbing uphill 562 and there's something or other. Very difficult for me to follow as a non-soldier, but the Navy's no better. It's always using jargon and navalese and acronyms, three-letter acronyms. The Navy lives on them, feeds on them, drinks it. And to try and cut all that out and present this in plain English that ordinary people that nothing about the Navy, had no naval service, would be able to understand, was the challenge. That was the first thing. How do we take the jargon out of it and make it meaningful? So the Navy might have said that some person got a gong because they did X, Y, and Z in this situation. You had to explain that in terms that the average reader, and we're starting at high school level, would understand. I'm not knocking high school readers. I'm simply saying their knowledge is much less. The second thing was you had to hang this on a framework. Putting together a pile of stories starting at A and ending at Z wasn't going to mean anything. It had to be tied to something. You had to try and show why the gong might have been awarded under these circumstances when 10 years earlier it wouldn't have been. The answer to that was to prepare a brief, but not too brief, history of the Royal Australian Navy. The Commonwealth Naval Forces before that, until 1911, and then the Royal Australian Navy. That was a challenge because, again, you're talking about matters that probably most Australians don't follow or don't have a great interest in, and try to explain why things happened and why they happened the way they did was one of the challenges. So writing was a problem, and presenting in a way that your Aunt Sally would understand was the other.
It sounds to me as though it's the type of book that you could pick up and start anywhere within the book.
You could. We decided that we would try to group things under activity headings, if you like. For example, we divided, if I'm remembering correctly, we divided World War II into five chapters. If you read a history like the official history of the RAN and World War II, that's two volumes, and it jumps from Palestine to Guadalcanal to the Philippines to Tokyo to Berlin to Arctic convoys. It had to be written that way, but it makes it very hard for the reader. And so we decided we'd put all the action in a temporal sense in one box. So if you want to know what the Navy did in the North Atlantic, the Australian Navy did in the North Atlantic during the Second World War, it's there. Or rather, should I say, if you wanted to know what members of the Royal Australian Navy did to get gongs in the North Atlantic in that period, it's there. Otherwise, it's not. That's not a defect of the book. It's simply a fact of life that there's never been yet written a history of the Royal Australian Navy in the European theatre in World War II. I'm not sure one ever will be, but we cover a lot of the gaps that have existed for a long time.
Just listening to what you have to say tells me a lot about the Navy's service and just how diverse it's been over those years.
You know, you step into the blue stuff, which is down at the end of the bay there, and that's the ocean. We call it the beach, but it's actually the ocean. And that ocean leads to every part of the world, and that's where it took the Royal Australian Navy.
When did you release Bravo Zulu Volume 1?
We managed to complete that manuscript and get it published by September 2016. As you see, it took 4 years from the research team joining us to get that part done. By which time, of course, we'd done a lot of research on Volume 2, but there were unique problems with that, and one of them was that we had too much information. Having complained that it wasn't enough, we now had too much. What I have attempted to do is to present for each recipient where they came from, where they were born, their background, when they joined the Navy, where they served in the Navy, and then as we get closer to the award, why they had the qualifications, expertise and so forth to actually be in a position they were put that won them the award. And then, of course, to describe what they actually did. So there's quite a lot to fit in a few lines, and I had the unique privilege, I think, of speaking personally with a lot of recipients, most of whom start off by saying, I didn't do anything special, I was only doing my job, to which I had to say, well, if you were only doing a job and it wasn't nothing special, how come you got the gong? And they said, oh, well, you know, I had a lot of help. So you'll see in the stories that a lot of people say that. I was just doing my job and I owe this award to the very many people who work with me and helped us achieve what we were trying to do. But then the problem came from the publisher's end saying, well, look, I'm sorry, this is far too big to publish. There's much too much information. How much information? About 100,000 words.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. So having rushed, I suppose is the correct word to use, to hope to get the second volume in print in 2017, I actually spent that year rewriting the entire volume 2 from the first word to the last. and cutting 100,000 words out of it, which made me weep. So much information had to go. But it was that or not have the book, so it was a compromise, as most things are, and I'm sorry about that. I think there's some excellent data that we've had to drop, but you've got a book at least.
Ian, what are you going to do with all of that data that you still have left over from both books?
I've decided to transfer it to the Sea Power Centre in Canberra. It's the Navy's repository for historical stuff, and they've begun to collect personal information. By that I mean service records and people writing memoirs about the good old days in HMAS, in the Galabi, and all that sort of stuff. Because up until they started that project, there'd been a lot of effort put into the official history. You know, HMAS thing sailed from here and did that, joined this ship, and they did that, and then they came back, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we call report of proceeding stuff. But the emphasis on people is growing, and back in 2001 or two, a colleague and I started a thing called the RAN Oral History Collection, which was taking interviews, like you've just done, with people who'd been in special places or done special things. That's had its ups and downs. I'm not sure where it is now. But that was the start of a concentration on people, because we've concentrated on grey-painted machinery for so long that we seem to have lost somehow what we always say is the most important factor is the sailor, but I think we'd lost that under the welter of, you know, technological stuff. We're always talking about weapons and aircraft and ships and new technology and cyber warfare and all that sort of thing. In all that, there are people, and the people are the people who run this. And putting the emphasis back on people, I think, is an important step forward in historiography, not just in the Navy, but I think it's important. And the Centennial of Anzac brought out a lot of personal stories, which is great, but we need to do it all the time. We can't just have a huge war and do it. We have to do it all the time.
Yeah. Was there much difference in the research task between Volume 1 and Volume 2?
Yeah, very much so. We were treading on reasonably well-known or possibly better understood ground up until 1964 when we finished Volume 1. And the reason for doing that, of course, is that in 1975, Australia introduced the Order of Australia as the principal award or the principal order under which awards were given to Australians. That didn't prevent them receiving other awards, but it meant that this was the principal one. And then there were modifications later on to bring in specifically military awards like conspicuous service medals and also medals for gallantry, which were not in the Order of Australia. So that's why the U was chosen. But, of course, in 1975, we'd finished with Vietnam. And from there on in, there were a series of shorter, sharper conflicts, in particular the Gulf War and the Iraq War, and the assistance we rendered in bringing peace to East Timor in 1999-2000. So it wasn't the concentration, if you like, of activity and honours and awards coming from. So it's a much more diverse book. The specialist chapters are only three or four. The rest of it is temporal, so from 1990 to 1995, that sort of stuff, just for 5-year brackets. And at the same time, whereas, of course, navies and organisations like Navy, large organisations, are changing all the time, the period of the 1990s and 2000s introduced quite enormous changes in the way the Navy did its business because of the implementation of what were called defence reforms. I've avoided, and I will not now make any comments on whether the reforms were worth the trouble, but certainly they caused a lot of disruption to all the services and to the Department of Defence. But a lot of the awards for that period were given to people for perseverance in trying to get the job done when it was being made more and more difficult for them to actually do it.
So how did you overcome those problems that you've just highlighted?
By doing a lot of talking, by reviewing what we'd written and then subjecting it to peer group consideration, to have people who were involved in those days to comment on the text to make sure that we were not getting things wrong or putting too gloomy a slant on it. But it must have been a very trying period. I'd left the Navy by this time, so that was the other problem, that none of us had any real experience of the Navy after about 1998. There was nothing from our own experience we could draw upon, so it had to be third-hand or second-hand. Therefore, we had to be very careful that we got it right. And, of course, there are always winners and losers. So some people would say, well, that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Others would say it wasn't. Depended where you stood to gain or lose from the reforms and what it meant for you in doing your daily work, whether it made your life easier or more difficult. And so we got into the period where you might or might not recall, most Australians probably don't, but in 2011, the Australian nation had no amphibious capability at all because the ships that we'd been using had all run out of steam or, in fact, were not really seaworthy and therefore shouldn't be used. That was a wake-up call. And that, in my interpretation, was the result of changes that were made in the lines of responsibility. Who is actually responsible for repairing ships, for example? In the old days, it was quite clear. It's the Navy's responsibility, and there was a guy, an admiral, whose job it was to do it. And he worked, of course, with dockyards and with civilian contractors, but the lines of responsibility were quite clear. And he had the authority to get on and make that happen. Under the reform system, that changed. We had a thing called the Defence Materiel Organisation, which was actually supposed to be acquiring and maintaining naval assets. Well, sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. And that's why there was a big inquiry after 2011 to try and sort it out yet again. How do you actually get ships maintained? Or sustained is the new word we use, sustained. The other issue was that, and I think most Australians were totally unaware of this, the period after Vietnam and then working up through the Gulf War and then through our the Navy's extensive experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan that doesn't have a Navy, there's no ocean, true, but there's an awful lot of RAN people who have served a lot of time in Afghanistan, not just in improvised explosive devices work, but also in talking with the Taliban, believe it or not, and also working with the Afghan army and defense forces to try and make them more efficient and more effective. But that's been going on since virtually 1996. You see a bit about it in the press from time to time when a ship seizes a huge quantity of drugs or money or something like that, but the Navy's been there all that time. That's changed a number of things. One is, it's changed the way the Navy thought about its main task, and we're now shifting back onto major, not confrontation, but being able to fight and win at sea. But the other thing it did is it made us part of a coalition, which existed in kind before, but is now much more developed, so that you find Australian naval officers and Australian naval personnel, full stop, in all sorts of interesting situations, particularly within the United States Armed Forces. That's a new area. You would look back 30 years ago and say, that's never going to happen, and discover it actually has. There are Australian naval officers doing all sorts of things in the most senior echelons of the US command system. And that's not the Navy, that's also the other two services as well. So the book covers a quite different environment from the rather more, shall we say, simpler days when there was a bad guy, we had to go out and do something about it, and we did.
So, Ian, it seems to me that there's a lot of history woven amongst the stories of these honours and awards.
Yes, there had to be, Helen.
So how have you presented that data?
Well, as I said, I hope in a publicly understandable way. Some people get very excited about strategy and policy and reform and all that sort of thing, but the average reader doesn't, unless he or she was personally involved in it. And one can understand why they get excited about it. I've tried to keep it level. The tone is level throughout the book. The only time I get excited, I think, is when it's an action, which I thought needed a little bit of highlighting. I've tried not to take any favourites. It's wrong to do that, but some stories just leap out at you.
You mentioned that the second volume has just been launched by the Chief of Navy.
Yes.
What was the reaction to the launch?
It went very well. We tried to invite a sample, if you like, of all the people who'd received honours and awards to attend the launch. That was partially successful, but it was an occasion when I, for the very first time, met some of the people I'd written about in the book. It's one of the better experiences of the whole project, to actually come face-to-face with the people you've been writing about and talk to them about their experiences and how impressed I was and the whole team was about what they had done. Could I add at that point that what kept us going through these dreary, dark years of difficult research was the stories we were uncovering were just absolutely fantastic. And we thought, we can't stop now. We have to carry on and print these because they're important to Australia's history, not just its naval history, but to the history of the nation. And they're such good stories. I mean, they're the sorts of things that, you know, breaking news on tonight's thing will have something about somebody doing something. Well, this happens all the time. Why were these people's deeds not given more prominence? I've no idea.
Well, I must tell you that I was at the commemoration service for the garden area at the new Jamie Larkin Centre here, which has replaced Ward 17 at the old Door Park Repat Hospital. And I was speaking to a young woman who is ex-Navy, and she was telling me that her husband is also in the Navy. And he'd just been mentioned in a book about honours and awards, and would you believe it's your book? And I told her that we'd be interviewing you within the next week or so, and she was just absolutely chuffed. She said her husband just couldn't be prouder of being in a book and having his service recognised. And it's not that he has a big head at all. It's just that it's that aspect of being recognised. Now, I know that you said you have no favourites and you try not to promote any stories over the other, but what are stories that move you?
Oh, so many hard questions.
Give us two. Just
two? Yes. Two is not enough.
Let me give you a quick
five or so. I was rung up a couple of days ago by a guy who said, my son, who's in working with the US Navy, there's another connection, he's a captain in the Royal Australian Navy working in Hawaii, says there's a book being written about honours and awards and he wants to make sure that your story's in it. And I said, what's your story? He said, oh, well, in 1921, HMAS Melbourne, a cruiser, rescued people from a sinking American schooner. And the U.S. president, and under very difficult conditions, the U.S. president gave them all a gold medal. I bet that's not in the book. Well, it is. I said, well, what's your connection with the story? He said, I was the ship's boy. And his son is now a captain in the Royal Australian Navy. So, you know, it's that sort of story. There's one. Doctor jumping into the boiler room of a sinking destroyer to rescue people who are unfortunately already dead. I mean, that sort of stuff. It's a long story. I don't want to make it long, but an Australian Navy boarding party in the Gulf got into difficulties when the ship they boarded was discovered to be right on the line between Iraq and Iran, and the Iranians took exception to that and came up waving weapons and brandishing things and hurling threats and told them they'd all surrender. Now, a British team in similar circumstances had done that, and the petty officer in charge, who I met at the launch, made the decision that wasn't going to happen to us, and it damn well didn't. I mean, good on him. He stuck by his guns, got his people off the ship safely, prevented an international incident, and when I met him, I took one look at him and thought, gee, I'd rather have you on my side than the other side. You're the sort of guy I'd love to work with. Young League Seaman Cook, in a patrol boat, you'll remember the terrible, terrible accident when a refugee boat smashed into Christmas Island in 2012. The weather was so bad that the Navy patrol boat and the customs boat were taking shelter from the weather. The skipper of this boat obviously didn't take any notice of that, and they had to go out in the most appalling conditions and rescue these poor drowning people who were all choking on diesel oil and being flung against the rocks and that sort of thing. So she did that. She was the sole medical person on board. They expected problems. They had broken arms. They had people retching their lungs out from this oil, that sort of thing. When that was all over, when they retired to put them ashore, she turned around and cooked dinner because that was her job.
Oh, goodness.
What a person. I mean, there's plenty of stories. The great thing about Bravo 2 is there are plenty of females in it. The women get mentioned. There was another Gulf incident where a U.S. patrol boat was ambushed by a suicide boat. The Australian Navy came to the rescue. They were dead and dying everywhere. It was a horrible scene. And this young medical officer led her, once again, her made-up team. We don't have very many medical people in warships. And they dealt with it with maturity and compassion and excellence. And they saved the people they could. Those they couldn't were taken ashore for burial. But the bravery, I mean, imagine a submarine. It's dark. It's night. It's rough. And three of your mates have been washed off the deck of the submarine. What do you do? Well, of course, you jump in the sea and rescue them, don't you? I can't. I hope I could do it, but I'm not sure I could. They succeeded. They were injured in doing so. But, I mean, that's the sort of spirit that exists within a ship, within the Navy. And these examples, just a few of the fabulous stories, are in the book.
Incredible. Ian, what's the next project on your plate?
Retirement, Helen.
Oh, no.
The project took a lot out of me, and it was hard on my family as well, because I spent 9 long years hunkered down in front of a computer, bashing away at it all day and night and early mornings, and it was just a very difficult experience. So I decided I'd finished my writing career. What I'm now going to do is become an agitator to get the Australian people to read more and understand more about their Navy, which has done magnificent things for the country and does it every single day of the year, is doing it right as we speak. But they don't know about it because, I don't know, the Navy doesn't publicise itself, or the media doesn't think it's interesting or whatever. But they're there today, men and women out there doing their job, no matter what the weather is, and they're still out there doing it, or where it is. They're there all over the world right now.
I think it's just that they haven't had the exposure that the Army has, because they really are appreciated. Everyone I speak to appreciates our Navy, our Air Force and our Army, and our Merchant Navy too.
Of course.
It's just that sometimes they don't get the stories, but having you on Service Voices spreads those stories, Ian, so it's great to have you on board with us. Thank you, Ian.
It's been my pleasure talking to you.